Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Feroz Darda was the senior partner in his private client tax practice in Mayfair, London, when a chance meeting with a freedom fighter and a Buddhist monk while on a family trip to Myanmar set him on an unexpected path that transformed the lives of hundreds of orphaned and abandoned children being looked after in a remote monastery on the shores of Lake Inle in Burma. The author of the book Children of the Revolution, which has achieved the rare honour of being endorsed by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Feroz Darda joins me tonight to share the astonishing true tale of how the courage and the tenacity of a small group of individuals from different religions and backgrounds helped a passionately caring, visionary Buddhist monk bring education and hope to thousands of Burma's poorest orphans and children. Feroz Darda, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. It's really nice to be on your show.
Feroz, you were born in Karachi.
That was a lovely introduction.
You were born in Karachi, but have lived and worked for most of your life in London, where, as a qualified chartered accountant, you enjoyed the fruits of your success as the senior partner of your own private client tax practice. The story you relate in Children of the Revolution started when you and your wife, Mumu, decided it was time you made your first visit to meet her family in Tongai? Is it Tongai?
It's Tongai.
Tangi. There are different pronunciations on the internet, so I had it completely wrong. Tangi, in the northeast of Burma. So take us back to that time and tell us what happened there to change the course of your life and your work.
Yes, the story really begins when we were traveling on Inle Lake. And Inle Lake is a very beautiful lake in a very remote part of Burma, in the Shan Hills. It's a lake which is about 45 square miles, so it's a long, big lake. And it's surrounded by mountains. It's one of the highest lakes in Myanmar, certainly in the highest lakes in the world. So you have a beautiful sight as you're traveling on the lake. Usually it's by way of canoe. Now this is a beautiful sunny day. And you could hear the birds singing on the shore, very few people around. And we'd probably traveled something like 20 miles south on the lake when suddenly the weather changed. And from what is a beautiful day, suddenly the clouds gathered, there was thunder and lightning. And when you're in a canoe, even though it's a lake, it gets really dangerous. And so I asked the major who was with us, one of the freedom fighters, said, let's go and take shelter. And really, when we took shelter, that's when it happened.
So you took shelter in a monastery. Before we talk about that, tell us a little bit about the companion that you were with, a tribal warrior and a freedom fighter named Major. Just tell us a little bit about him so we can get a bit of background.
Hmm. Well, Major, and he asked me to call him Major because that was his rank in the Bo'o Army. Bo'o Army was one of these ethnic groups which were fighting against the Myanmar, I would say tyranny, the government at that time, for freedom and for better rights for the ethnic group. He was a major by way of rank in that army, and he was not just a freedom fighter, but he was running away from the government, if you see what I mean. He was a haunted man. So part of the story relates to him, you know, trying to keep away from the law, as it were.
Yes, and I mean, he'd had quite an interesting background. I mean, in just a few words, just give us a sketchy outline of his background and what you were doing with him.
So actually, Major was in the Bo'o army, but his job was really to be a spy. So he was a spy master within the Bo'o organization. And he fed information, he recruited new people to join the army, he smuggled arms. So he was really at the sharp end of the freedom movement. I met him really when I arrived at this hotel called GIC Hotel on the lake a year before. And that's where I met him, and I decided he was such an interesting and charismatic person, I wanted to write about him.
And so you went back to Myanmar to have meetings with him so that you could get more of his story.
Indeed. Yes, indeed. But of course, one man led to another, as it were.
Yes, yes. Yes, there's no such thing as accidents.
No.
So there you are, taking shelter from this terrible storm in this monastery when you meet the head monk, Ponji. That's what everybody calls him at this Buddhist monastery.
Yes.
And you were surprised to find it wasn't just a monastery. Tell us what else was going on there.
Well, actually, the turning point, I would say, is when I looked at this, I would say a man, yes, okay, I call him a man, standing there in his saffron robes, and I felt a surge of energy hit me, literally. I literally fell back, and I said to myself, who is this? What is this person? So I think that was a new sensation. There was a new feeling of energy hitting me. I didn't know what was happening at that time. So when we sat down and Ponji, the monk, was beginning to talk to Mumu, who for a moment he thought was a foreigner, but of course then realized that she was Burmese. And as they were talking to each other, I had the chance to observe this conversation, but more importantly, to observe this man. And I think that what happened later confirmed my sort of, I wouldn't say suspicions, but my feeling of amazement, a feeling of bafflement, if you like, as to what was going on.
So, expand on that a bit.
Yes.
It sounds like you were a little reluctant to reveal much.
No. Well, the conversation ended, the sun came out, and it was time to go. But he said, hold on, let me show you around the monastery. And as we walked around the monastery, all we saw were children, you know, children laughing, children playing. The well-dressed children looked very happy and looked very content, and some of them spoke a little bit of English, so we managed to talk to them. But then I asked the monk, what are all these children doing here? And he said, we look after them. We look after these orphaned and abandoned children. And I think at that time he said there were 350 or 400 children. And I knew then that a handful of monks looking after so many children who were so happy with so little was confirming my feeling or initial feeling as these people were special. These monks were special, and this particular monk was something really amazing. So that is what.
So we should say here that a little bit about Ponji's background, that he'd been handed one orphan at the height of the wars 20 years prior. And he was a young man at the time, but he'd adopted the child and brought him up with the help of a village lady. And he'd begun to educate the boy. And then gradually more and more children began to arrive over the following years.
And of course, he would never turn anybody down.
Right.
And his mission, we found later, was education, 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 to enlightenment. So, besides taking the kids, which is fine, as other monasteries might even do, he took it upon himself, really, to also educate these children. And later on, I found out how and what he had to do to raise the money and to make that happen. In itself, an amazing story.
Yes, I mean, really, I don't know how he managed to feed that many children, yes. But it was certainly hard going. Let's diverge just slightly, but give a bit of background here on Burma or Myanmar. Why are there so many abandoned children in Burma?
Well, people might know that Burma had been cut off from the rest of the world for something like 60 years. And it was ruled really by the army, and the general at that time was General Nawin. And he was a cruel dictator, I'm sure that's right to say. And he cut the people off from the outside world. He also then persecuted the minorities that surround the outskirts of Burma, within Burma, and there are 35 different ethnic groups. So there was the infighting, insurgencies going on. And for that reason, really, Burma was not a safe country to go, even if you could go. And most people were not allowed visas to enter Burma. So it went into hibernation. The Pa'o people at that time were also fighting or being persecuted by the military. And that's really where a lot of the Pa'o people died in this conflict and resulted in not just orphans, but also incredible poverty and all other hardships that followed, you know. So that was, and Pongi was, this, if you like, the safety net of that little area around the Pa'o Mountains.
And the statistics on, you know, relating to the life of children in Burma are pretty, were pretty horrific at that time. Yes. Just tell us a few of those to put this in context.
Well, I don't know offhand, but actually I think it probably ranks at, or certainly ranked at one of, if not the first, I think the second highest mortality rate for children at that time. And then several million orphan children. Things are improving a little bit, but certainly at that time it ranked as one of the highest, if not the highest.
Well, let me just quote something from your book where you say that one in five will die before their fifth birthday, and one of the biggest killers is malaria. And according to UNICEF, around 56,000 children under the age of five die there every year from largely preventable diseases. And of these, more than 40,000 are less than a month old. One of the main reasons behind this is the lack of safe drinking water. Now, that's an important point to mention because it takes us back to Pongi and your story, because you helped them come up with a way of becoming self-sufficient and being able to feed and educate and clothe these children. So just tell us a little bit about that.
So I think we need to take off back to the monastery and my first visit there. As we were leaving, Pongi asked me, he said, we don't get visitors here. Foreigners are not allowed. And that is true, at that time they were not. And he said, what did you think? And I had no time really to think other than what comes straight from the heart. Sometimes often foolish things come from the heart, or it might appear to be foolish. And I said, I wish these children had computers. To which, of course, he looked and said, children haven't seen a computer. we have no electricity here. And I think something happened to me at that time. And I felt embarrassed that I should be saying I wish they had more food or more clothing. But something happened to me which opened a door in my mind. And I remember I walked through that door and said, why not? Why can't these children have the things that we have? Why not? I can do it. I can help them. And I think that was the door that opened at that precise moment. And I walked through that door and everything changed.
And that was a very pivotal moment in your life, yes. Being able to help them.
Yeah.
Yes. And you did indeed take computers there.
So we went back, and a few months later, Mumu and I said we must do something. And actually what we did was smuggle a handful of laptops and some solar panels through customs, which would have been pretty dangerous thing to do at that time if we'd been caught. But anyway, we managed to do that and set off again to the monastery and arrived there. And really, that was the beginning of our relationship with the monastery, and there was no turning back from that point.
You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with author Feroz Dada, whose book, Children of the Revolution, which has been endorsed by the Dalai Lama, tells a true tale of how a Buddhist monk, a freedom fighter, and a chartered accountant brought education and hope to thousands of Burma's poorest orphans. We'll be back with more from Feroz Dada after this break.
The future of internet radio is here. Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Hi, this is New Age Grammy winner Paul Avgerinos. Thanks for listening to Om Times Radio, and please support my peaceful healing music with a purchase at iTunes, Amazon, or wherever you shop for fine music. Just put my name into the search engine, Paul Avgerinos, A, V like Victor, G like George, E-R-I-N-O-S. You can also visit me at roundskymusic.com. Thanks for listening, and I'm wishing you the brightest of blessings.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Feroz Dada, I'm not sure if it was the computer trip or one of the later trips, because you made many, but one afternoon, Ponji took you on an inspection tour of the monastery land, and he asked you if, with your business experience, you could see a way of achieving an income from the land to help pay for the upkeep of the school and the orphanage. Now, that was another major pivotal moment in your relationship with the monastery. Tell us what happened from there.
So before that particular hook or question that Ponji asked, and Ponji, incredibly wise man, he spent a lot of time with us, teaching us about Buddhism, teaching us about spirituality. And I wanted to capture all that, because what I saw was these beautiful children who were happy in spite of the great poverty and the hardship. And I wanted to capture the reasons for that so I could bring them home and to share with all the people and the stress that we go through and the children's difficult lives in the West. So I wanted to capture that. And that a lot of that is in the book. But once we'd sort of, I wouldn't say finished, but he spent many days, many days, nights talking about and teaching us, he then raised this question. He says, Feroz, I've taught you as much as I can. Now you teach me what you know about making money or making this monastery sustainable. So he left me actually on the land, and I wandered around looking for different ideas. And actually, I came up with quite a few ideas, but the most profound idea, which I knew was perfect, is when I saw a stream of water coming down from the mountain, and something happened, really. It was inspiration or divine hint, call it what you like. And I could see that water being bottled and sold. I had the vision. I could even see the bottle itself, you know, what it might look like. So in a sense, I went back to the monk and I said, monk, look, I think we have a great idea. What do you think if we purify this water? The children can drink it anyway, because that's beautiful. It's good water, improve their health. And the surplus water we'll bottle and sell. Now, there are quite a few people around at that time sitting around, including Major and others, and they all thought I was completely crazy. How are you going to have a mineral water factory in a place where there was no electricity? There was nothing there. There's no machinery. How are you going to get the machinery there? But the monk looked at me and he says, Feroz, that's a great idea. Let's do it. So that
well,
was
he
a
had
moment of inspiration.
I had a note somewhere of a wonderful comment that gave you great inspiration about imagination. Do you recall what he used to say?
Of course. Well, I think that really helped me make up that particular inspiration, if you like. He said, think even beyond your imagination, you know, even beyond, everything is possible. Go beyond your imagination. And I think that was the word that kept echoing in my mind. Yes, I think we could do it. So what is difficult? And I think that was really what it was. It was courage and his guidance, his inspiration. And I realized that we were going to do it, because he believed in it, I believed in it. Nothing was going to stop this happening.
And also to put that into context, you know, the pressures on the country's infrastructure make the government target of providing clean drinking water to everyone a major challenge. According to the United Nations, deforestation from logging, industrial development, new housing and agriculture, which currently use 75% of water resources, all add to the challenge. So water, I mean, it really was not just an inspired idea, but I mean, so fundamental to the health and well-being.
Yes, you see, previously at the moment, what's been happening recently is that the agricultural activity on the lake actually happens on the lake itself, not on the land. It just actually happens on the lake. They have found a way to grow vegetables on floating gardens on the lake itself. But they do use a lot of fertilizers, which means that the children who are able to drink decent or half-decent lake water are actually drinking poisonous water. And consequently, their health had begun to deteriorate. So this is not really a question of just sustainability. It was also a question of saving the children and giving them good water. That was actually quite important in this thinking. So it was really two birds with one stone.
So how long did it take from having that idea to having the bottled water in your hands?
Yes, I mean, I do remember. I think it was 20th of August 2014 when it all came to fruition, which is really about 18 months from when we had this idea. And of course, what do I know about water factories? Nothing, zero. But you know, it's one of those amazing things that I only value looking back in the mirror. At that point in time, I thought I was amazing. I could do these things. I was making something miraculous happen. But actually, I realized, looking at the rear mirror of my life, I see that actually more things were happening. People were appearing from everywhere. People were helping in every way they could. If I wished for something, it would happen. It was some bizarre happening, which I would say is karma. You know, the children were looking for someone to help them, and I was the instrument. I can say that now, not at that time, I can say that now, and people just came around and made it happen. So it's wrong for me to say I did it, but perhaps I thought that for a moment in time, but truthfully it was so many, many, many people who made this happen.
Yes, and you helped raise money. I mean, 18 months is a pretty short period.
Yes.
You know, to take a project of that size when you know nothing about it and make it happen.
That's why I say what I said. I didn't make it happen.
I'm saying for all of you who made it happen, you still did an incredible job in just 18 months. Now, did you have any problems or challenges with the fighting that was still going on?
Well, actually, the actual fighting has stopped at that time. The fighting between the poor people and the army. So that was sort of taking a more peaceful mood. More tourists were coming. You know, the environment was changing. There were hotels being built. So tourism had started. So that particular part of the environment was beginning to change. The backdrop was changing. So we didn't have that tension, thankfully, to contend with.
So while this was happening, as if you weren't busy enough, running your London company and making trips back and forth and raising money for the monastery, you also wrote the book. And you wrote the book not just about Major, but about Pongee and about your trip and you know, the things that were happening to you along this journey. And you incredibly managed to get an endorsement from the Dalai Lama. Tell us how that came about, because that is a rare privilege.
Very rare. Actually, again, you know, when I was with the monk and watch, and the more and more children coming, by the way, and today we have 1,200 children. So throughout this period of time, more and more children were beginning to come. This time now, abandoned children or poor children. HIV was an issue in the people there, so that way a lot of lives were lost and children were abandoned. So a lot of things were beginning to happen, Sandy, at that time. So I could see the monk. I could see him being distressed under pressure with so many children. He still wouldn't say no, and I said, "Look, monk, can you ask one of your, you know, your boss, if you like, to help you, because if the Dalai Lama himself spoke up and said, guys, help this monk, I'm sure a lot of people would get up and do things, not realizing that actually the Buddhist hierarchy in Nepal and in India is different from that of Burma. Having said that, I said, why don't you ask His Holiness? And the monk said, I'm a lowly monk, you know, I'm only a low monk. How can I ask the great Dalai Lama to help me? So he wasn't going to do it, which meant I said I would write to him, and I sent him a copy of the earlier version of the book. And I said to him, not expecting anything, I said, look, would you endorse the book? Because if you do, it'll help sell and raise money. But if you can't, pray for our success, and that would be great too, you know. So at least he'd be able to do something. Of course, to my surprise, to my great joy, he wrote back and said, I'm happy to endorse the book and pray for your success. So not only did we get that endorsement, but actually what it did was put me on to the spot and said, look, now you've got to perform, my friend. You know, you've got to really, really do your job, and don't let His Holiness and His endorsement and His prayers but come true. So I think that put me and others around me on a more serious path towards helping the children.
Yeah, absolutely. But it must have been just an incredible moment for you when you heard that the Dalai Lama was going to endorse the book.
Yes, amazing. And
yeah, it's like getting an endorsement from God, isn't it?
Well, actually, I expected something different. I expected other people to help, but what it actually did was to put a responsibility upon me which is greater than I had actually even accepted. And that led me to go back to the office and say, I'm giving up my accounting practice and spending my time doing this. So actually that put the whole process into more formal and more committed route. And really from that point onwards, I began to spend more time at the monastery and actually less time in the office.
And despite the fact that Ponji did not speak English, you know, as you've said, you did manage to get, you know, some incredible conversations with him, which, you know, a delightful little, you know, jewels in the midst of the narrative of, you know, what was going on there, because his wisdom is just, well, it's timeless, isn't it? And it's just what we know, but we need to hear again and again. But one thing that really interests me is we all know that there have been a lot of challenges in Burma, especially for the Rohingya people, who there's been a lot of massacring going on. And I think you asked him, didn't you, at one point, given that Buddhism is such a peaceful practice, how is it that some Buddhist monks justify aggression and preach violence? Tell us what he said in response to that.
Well, it's in the book, but I don't remember verbatim, but what I do remember him saying over several different conversations. You see, the most important point is the good people and bad people in the world. It's got nothing to do with religion. Good people exist in Buddhism, they exist in Islam, they in Christianity, and everywhere. And bad people also exist. They just exist. So it is wrong for those people who are bad people, who don't comply with Buddhist principles, to call themselves Buddhists. They're not Buddhists, actually. They should be, and his advice really always been, you have to be kind, you have to be merciful, you have to be forgiving. And that is the Buddhist way. If you're not following that sort of practice, you're not a Buddhist, and certainly you're not a Buddhist monk. And, I mean, he's very clear, and puts this in perspective and saying, you know, human beings are human beings. They're good people, bad people, you know. And so that's the way he explained it to me.
You also asked him how it was that the monastery seemed so calm and serene. It ran like clockwork with never a word spoken loudly, let alone in anger. The children were so happy and well behaved. So how did he achieve that?
Okay, again, you know, this is perhaps I was very slow on the take up there. I looked at the situation and said, oh, this must be to do with just Buddhism. So I began to understand Buddhist practice, and he taught me. I realized, of course, those were great words. They're words of peace and philosophy of life and the way to live. But they are words. I knew I was missing something which is beyond speaking and beyond words. So I said to him one day, monk, you're hiding something from me. And he said, I'm not hiding anything from you. And I said, look, let me follow you from the moment that you wake up till the moment you sleep, just to make sure that I'm not missing anything. And he said, okay, I'm very happy for you to do that. My day starts at, I think he said, 3:30 a.m. And I start my day with meditation outside in the pagoda. And there was no roof at that time in that part of the monastery. And it was December, I remember, perhaps 0 degrees, very cold on the lake. And he said, come join me. And that's when my day begins. I remember I crawled out of my I wouldn't say it's a bed because we slept on the floor, and went to the pagoda. And there he was sitting already in meditation, and there was a mat next to him. He anticipated my coming, which is very good, but he didn't clearly want me to disturb him. So I took my place. I did meditation before, Sufi meditation. I sat with him, and we meditated together for maybe half an hour, 45 minutes. Then he turned around, he took my hands, and he said, let us meditate together for humanity. And by that time, the children began to quietly arrive and surrounded us. And there would have been 500 children quietly sitting, watching these two old men in meditation. I don't know what they'd be thinking. But then he turned around and he started chanting with the children. And then after chanting, he began to tell them to go into meditation. So they all, the children around, began to go in, you know, went into meditation. Now, at this point, my mind was beginning to feel certain sensations, but also, in a sense, a message was coming through to me. And the message was saying, do you know what this wisdom is about? Do you know what this happiness is about? It is about this meditation. And so you see, that's how I realized that these children were happy, they're peaceful, mm-hmm. they were content, because this meditation master was not imparting just the words. He was also imparting his spiritual energy to the children. And that was hitting the mark. It wasn't the words, it wasn't the teaching, yeah. It was the energy of a great human soul. And I think at that point I realized that I knew I'd solved the mystery.
You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is first-time author Feroz Dada, whose book, Children of the Revolution, tells how a Buddhist monk, a freedom fighter, and a chartered accountant brought education and hope to thousands of Burma's poorest orphans. We'll be back with more from Feroz Dada after this break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me the voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
Hi, this is recording artist and composer Yuval Ron, inviting you to a voyage through the chakras, a new double album of guided meditations to transform your life, a sublime musical medicine for nourishing inner peace and reaching to your higher virtues. Get it now at metamindfulnessmusic.com, M-E-T-T-A, mindfulnessmusic.com.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. For Rose Dada, Children of the Revolution also traces your own journey as a Muslim, absorbing Buddhist philosophy. Now, I know from the book that for some years before your trip to Myanmar, you'd been putting tentative toes into spiritual waters. And clearly, your meeting with Major Ponji and the children at Lake Inlay Monastery transformed your ideas and beliefs about living a meaningful life. What are the most important things that you learned?
So, a lot of these things, before I answer that question, I just want to square the point about the monk Ponji and his teachings and his energy. If you remember, I said to you, when I first saw the monk, I felt the surge of energy. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, of course, that it was the energy that I felt which was also working on the children. Now, I think that squared the circle for me. Now, going back to your question, my spiritual journey began really when I met my Sufi spiritual master. And that was just before I left for Burma. He said to me, Feroz, once you go onto this path, and he called this the path of roses, you will never want to turn back again. He said to me, I remember, he said, you try and read these books and you read, go to lectures and you listen to whatever, films or books or whatever you do. This is not where spirituality lies. Spirituality lies within yourself. You have to go into stillness, you have to go into meditation. And he's the one who sowed the seeds. Now, all this time, those seeds were beginning to germinate, if you like. I didn't realize that actually the real journey was not, in a sense, for me. The real journey was a spiritual journey running side by side this physical journey of helping people. They're both intertwined. And when I met the monk, I realized, and that's why I felt the energy, I was open and aware of what was happening spiritually. So that was the beginning of the spiritual journey. Then I found the monk, and then I also learned a lot about Vipassana meditation, which is the deep meditation that Buddha also used to practice. And I realized that actually a lot of the inspiration, a lot of this divine forces that were helping me and all the people that were helping me were to do really with the spiritual energy that was surrounding this project and, in a sense, surrounding me.
It's so interesting how the choices we make, and some of those that we don't even know we're going to make, have such an incredible impact, leading us along a path that really, when we look back on it, is like a string of pearls, you know, with one leading inevitably to another.
Actually, I was just writing my next book, and I remember I just started with this point, saying, You know, when life is, when you're in the moment of life, it's like a zigzag up and down, you know. But when you look at the rear mirror of your life, you will see that it's gone in a perfect manner, like an arrow in full perfect flight. I think the problem with human beings is that we cannot see beyond our noses. Only the spiritual hierarchy, if you believe in that point, is able to see beyond human sight. And if you're guided by these divine forces, then they take you in a direction that you would not be able to go by yourself. And I think really that is what the spiritual path is, where somebody else beyond yourself is guiding you and helping you and facilitating these things happening for a good humane cause. I think that was really what was happening throughout that time. But when you're in the journey itself, deep in it, you don't understand. But if you're open to it and you look back, it all then begins to make sense that it is more spiritual than physical. Of course, physical effort is important. That is our obligation. That's a necessary step. But the outcome, of course, much depends upon the spiritual aspect.
Mm. Now, you set up the Inlay Trust charity to provide the relief of poverty and education in Myanmar, and so far have set up educational, healthcare and water facilities at the monastery. And in a conversation you and I had a couple of weeks ago, you said they're also now setting up a sewing school so that the children can, you know, gain the skill of sewing and sew uniforms which they can sell to other children outside the school, which is all pretty wonderful, the way it all meshes together. And they're also creating a teacher training centre. What else?
Yes. Well, actually, the teachers training centre is really... I just go back a little bit, you know. My last trip, or just the trip before the last trip, the monk called me and he said, "Feroz, you've been working so hard. I just want to share with you that you have fulfilled your promise, you know. The monastery is self-sustaining and you don't need to do any more." I think he wasn't quite saying that, but he said the time for doing is gone. This time for spiritual development. Mm-hmm. But equally he was saying that if you want to do other things, do them for a wider purpose, not just for the monastery, and I'm here to help you also. And then that was the idea of a teacher's training center, which will not only teach the teachers at the monastery, but actually teach the teachers throughout Shan State and maybe one day throughout Burma itself. And of course, my partners, my colleagues in this are the teachers from the Great Charterhouse School in the United Kingdom. Of course, it's like the richest school, if you like, in the world, teaching the poorest school in the world.
Isn't that wonderful?
It is unbelievable. And I was speaking to them only 2-3 weeks ago after our first pilot project, and they are so excited and they are mesmerized. And actually they said what I said when I first went there: we learned more from the children than we believe we taught them.
Yes.
And which they meant humility, kindness, happiness, love, you know, all those qualities that we have forgotten in the Western world somewhat. Mm. So,
and of course, sorry, did you want to finish something?
No, project which will take some time to expand, and it is sort of has no limitation in a sense, of course.
Wonderful. So following on from Ponji's comments to you to take the message out into the world and personal development and sharing. You're now a guest interviewer with TV Apex, which is a community TV production, and you've interviewed everyone from a Buddhist monk, presumably that's Ponji, to the legendary Andrea Bocelli, on the subject of humanity. So what are you hoping to achieve with these interviews?
Well, I think it really is a continuation of that thought, that experience, that happiness cannot be bought by money. Happiness comes. Now, I'll tell you the answer, sorry. I'm sure you know, Sandy. But so my question was to find out from all these amazing people who are in the charity business, by the way. Andrea Bocelli is a great charity man. Joseph Calea, the great opera singer, has his own charity. These are all charity people. And what I wanted them to say, without me prompting them, is that happiness, how is real and peaceful and sustained happiness or peace come from? And do you know, Sandy, what they all said in the end of the interview, if you like? They said happiness comes from helping other people.
Yes.
That was really what I wanted the message to go out. You know, but I you know, when you say something, one person says something, it doesn't work. I wanted different people from different parts of the world, in different professions, in different talents, to say in their way that happiness actually comes from helping others.
Yes, it does. And I think it was Ponji who said to you that what holds us back from living mindfully is clinging to ourself and to our self-importance. Yes. Our belief in me or what is mine distracts us from the path of the Dharma, and we need to change our habits if we're to grow. There is no self and no other, and we all want the same, which is to be happy.
Yes.
Go on.
Yes, words. That's the difficulty of words. Words come to your head and then they go out. And my idea again was to get different people to say it in different ways so some of it would stick, you know. That really was the purpose of these interviews.
Yes. Well, where can our listeners watch these interviews?
Oh, if they go to www.inlaytrust.org.uk. So Inlay Trust is INLETRUST. They can buy the book from there, although it's available in most bookshops in the world. They're available from Amazon. And there's also a page which gives a link to all the television programs that I've made so far. And you know, they're free of charge to watch. I think the 15 or 20 programs. So it's all available for people to enjoy and learn.
How wonderful is that? And you're having the time of your life being able to travel and interview these people. And I watched one a couple of weeks ago of you at Damanhur, one of my favorite places.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. And there you are. You know, there's a very simple question I was asking, a slightly different topic. And asking them, what is spirituality? And although such an easy question, people found it difficult to answer.
Yeah, that's my dream job, actually. You know.
you do a great job anyway.
Oh, that's wonderful. So tell me briefly before we run out of time. We've got about a minute. Yeah. What is the new book about, Rose?
The new book is really is called The Disciple, and that means, in a sense, my learning of spirituality from my spiritual master, the one I met some 8 years ago. Of course, in this amazing beautiful journey. I've accompanied him on many pilgrimages, including Jerusalem, Ephesus, Rome, and hopefully soon to Egypt, where he, you know, spends his time teaching me and some of his other students. So really it is about the experience of learning spiritual concepts, understanding spirituality, and hopefully a path to go down that route.
Well, I hope so that when the book is published, you will come back and share some of its material with us.
Thank you. Thank you. And I hope you call me.
Feroz Dada, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on your show, Sandy. Thank you very much. I'm grateful.
My pleasure. All proceeds of Children of the Revolution go to the Monastery School and Orphanage in Leigh. You can purchase the book online, hardback, paperback copies at filamentpublishing.com and the Kindle version at amazon.com. And for more information on the In Leigh Trust and to follow its events, visit inletrust.org.uk. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.